Little by Little, a South Dakota nonprofit is helping in Haiti. What happens when one of its co-founders is no longer welcome in the U.S.? You're listening to SDPB's In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld the Trump administration's plan to end temporary protected status, or TPS, for more than 330,000 Haitians currently living legally in the U.S. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security has said conditions for TPS no longer exist in Haiti. But mass deportations of Haitian asylum seekers back to a country still gripped by political violence doesn't sit well with some South Dakotans. Haiti remains at a level 4 do not travel advisory. The U.S. State Department warns of kidnappings, crime, and unrest. Bruce Bloomer is co-founder of a South Dakota-based nonprofit called Haiti Alive. He stopped by the SDPB studios in Sioux Falls for an update. And a note to listeners, this interview was recorded before the TPS for Haitians living in the U.S. expired.
So Haiti Alive is a ministry that's been officially a nonprofit since 2013, and we work on an island. So about 50 miles northwest of Port-au-Prince is this island of Laganoff. And so we have worked on that island. It's a 40 by 10 mile island. So the good news is it's away from Port-au-Prince, and some of the things that people may have heard about that are going on. But the other part of that is it's hard to get there. And so supplies and other resources are more difficult. Since the beginning, we've been involved in healthcare, education, and supporting women, children, and the elderly. That has been our focus since the beginning, and it is to this day. And so it started as a small ministry. After I was there during the earthquake in 2010, and I just kind of had this passion, like, we got to do something. And so we now have a school. It's a two-level school, K through 9. It's about 250 kids, and we feed them every day. We have two clinics. We're actually making an extension on one of the clinics in the village, so it'll actually have the ability to have a birthing area and have overnight stays in the hospital. And then we also do some feeding programs. We did start a village. It's a home for women and their families. And we have built 64 homes for the women and their families. And one of the things that kind of unheard of in Haiti is we actually have indoor plumbing and we have running water. And so we actually had to teach some of the families how to use a toilet. They'd never used a flush toilet before. And so we do some feeding programs. We do a large Christmas program, some things like that. But our focus is, like, how do we educate kids so they have a brighter future? How do we provide health care so people can stay alive and be vital? And then how do we support women, children, and the elderly? Those are really vulnerable populations in Haiti.
And if I remember correctly, these pillars were because you asked. You said,
"Yeah,
what if we could help you? What would you need?"
Yeah, exactly. So the earthquake is in 2010. I went back to 2011 by myself, and I interviewed pastors and leaders and women's groups and honestly anybody who had talked to me, and I just said, if we could help, what do you need? And it was just absolutely clear. We need education, we need healthcare, and we need support for women, children, and the elderly. And so that's where the focus came from. And it started out of a church in Mitchell, and they started supporting a young man to go to medical school. We started sending some money for medicine and some food and scholarships so kids could go to school. And then it continued to grow, and as you know, we had people that blessed us continue to grow, and so it became too large for the church. And so in 2013, we became a separate nonprofit, and it's actually been better. It's that way we can talk to different kinds of churches and different kind of people. It's not just a Methodist church thing. It's a nonprofit that serves really a population that needs us, but we've also been blessed to be a part of that.
What was your experience during the earthquake like that you still recall today and carry with you from that time?
You know, it's just like it happened yesterday. I mean, it was 16 years ago now, and I was standing in this clinic and I heard this rumble, and I thought, gee, it sounds like the kids are running up and down the stairs. Well, I knew that couldn't be. And then I thought, God, it sounds like a train. Well, there are no trains in Haiti. And all of a sudden it was like, oh, wow, an earthquake. I'd never been through an earthquake. And so we went outside. There was a large field outside the clinic. And I remember standing there and thinking, oh, cool, I made it through an earthquake, you know. Yeah. And then we were going to go back in the earthquake, or go back in the clinic, I'm sorry. And then we had a large aftershock. The thing that was just really stands out to me is that night people were so afraid to be in their homes that they all put sheets out on this large field. It looked like it snowed. It was just like a solid white with sheets. And people slept out that night because they were afraid to be in the buildings. It actually wasn't until probably 2 days later, my son went into one of the resources in the village, and he came back and he said, man, he said, Dad, this is bad. And I go, what do you mean? He goes, Port-au-Prince is catastrophic. You know, it's catastrophic. Mm-hmm. And then it was just a matter of like, how do we get home? You know, and so there's a lot of stories about, you know, getting home and that kind of stuff. But It still, even like I came back and it wasn't that much longer. I had after the earthquake, I had a cement truck rumble behind me, and I grabbed my steering wheel, just that you carry that little bit of, you know, it really was traumatic. I mean, in retrospect, it was something that we went through. We're not part of the catastrophic, things that happened in Port-au-Prince, but we saw all the, you know, we had people that came from Port-au-Prince for medical care, and we had to drive through Port-au-Prince to get to the airport. We saw how incredibly, catastrophic it was, and we could smell the death and we could see the destruction. It was tough. It was tough.
After that time, the U.S. government issued temporary protected status for Haitians in America.
Right.
And now we are talking together on a week when that status is set to expire. The Supreme Court upheld the Trump administration's efforts to eliminate that for Haitians living legally with protected status.
Right.
It was intended to be temporary, but it was not intended to be lifted until the situation in Haiti had stabilized so people could return home. And the people who would like that status to be continued are saying, we're not there yet. There is no way the security is stabilized in Haiti. The infrastructure is stabilized. This is going to be a massive disruption to send more than 300,000 people and deport them through the airport at Port-au-Prince and into Haiti. Yeah. Tell me how all this, I'm not asking you to weigh in on the politics of of what's happening in the federal government, but how will it impact, how is it impacting Haiti life?
So our doctor, Dr. William, and his wife, who's also a doctor, Dr. Natalie, came here about 2 years ago. They were on a list to be kidnapped by the gangs. And so if people aren't aware, Port-au-Prince is basically being run by gangs. And so if you want to go down the main highway, you have to pay gangs to get down the road. And so when we have to bring supplies to our island, it's expensive because we have to pay gangs. So how it has affected us is now William and Natalie are going to have to leave the United States. They don't feel welcome here. The thing that's really disturbing for me, or I don't understand, is they came here under a program legally. They applied for the program. They came here. They had to have sponsors, which we sponsored them. They came here. They were working, both employed. They're paying taxes. Their kids were in school. So they did exactly what the administration asked to do, and then they took the status away from them. Yes, it was meant to be temporary, but it was put in there for places that it was not safe to be there. And Haiti is not safe. We can't fly teams into Port-au-Prince because it's not safe. There are people that have been here 10 years or longer that have no connections to Haiti more. They've built their family here. They've built their life here. They're working. They're doing the job that they're doing jobs that sometimes people here don't want to do. And that status is being taken away. I don't understand it. And so there are our doctors are making plans to go back to Haiti or possibly Canada. And it it's disturbing for me personally that our country makes people feel like they're not welcome. And especially when they are under, if you know anything, it would take you 10 seconds to figure out that, that Port-au-Prince is not a safe place to return people to. And so I don't understand how we're returning that number of people back. Now, there may be some issues that I'm not aware of in other places, but I'm just telling you, the people that I know here locally in Iowa and around Sioux Falls area, they're all working. They're here because it's not safe for them in their home. Dr. William was going to go back to Haiti for a period of time. One of his son does not have a Canadian visa. And so he has to go back to Haiti and then apply to the Canadian embassy to get Nathan, his son, a visa. And when that is procured, they will likely end up in Canada. And so there's...
Meanwhile, he remains on a kidnapping list?
He does. And so, you know, we feel he's pretty safe on the island of Loganov, but because there aren't gangs there, it's not controlled by gangs, but he has to get there. And so how does he get there safely? And so he is, because they're doctors, they assume that they are people that have money. And so they are on a list to be kidnapped because that they are potentially people that where they can get some money from, extort some money from them. Mm-hmm. And so Natalie and the kids are going to be in a different part of the United States for a period of time until he gets that visa, and I think they'll end up in Canada. But how it affects us is indirectly. And so it's just that our kind of our main contacts in Haiti, and William really is our main person. We call him an in-country coordinator. He's the person that runs all of our ministries. He is in contact with people daily about with our school. And we have good people on the ground in Haiti, and that really helps. But he's the one that coordinates all that. So he's mm-hmm. in contact with the school and the village and all that kind of stuff to make sure that all our ministry is going well. And so how does that get disrupted while he's being disrupted? That's the concern.
Yeah. What is the work in front of you today with the Women's Village, with the school, with the clinics? What do you, when you're making the ask right now in for Haiti Alive, what's the work ahead?
So one of the things that I tell people that I'm really excited about is we have 64 homes that are done in the village. It's completed. We realized that we couldn't just support all those people all the time. So we started a microloan program. And so we give small loans to women and sometimes in cases of men to start a small business. It's been wildly successful. I mean, we had a young guy, he bought a used motorcycle for $350. We gave him that loan. He delivers bread to all the small villages, and then they use motorcycles as taxis. And so he paid us back $35 a month, and in 10 months that loan was paid back, and now he has a successful business. And we have a woman who started a sewing business. She sews uniforms for like our school and people in the village, and now she paid her loan back, and she's got a successful sewing business. And that's a lot of like, you know, people sell pop and water and hair products and fingernails, all of those kinds of things that, you know, you might expect in a women's village. But we have had a large number of people that have developed some really neat niches and businesses so they can support themselves. And so we've had about a 70% payback. It's way more than I expected. And every time that loan gets paid back, we can give another loan to another woman. And the thing I like about that is it's they are helping themselves and they are becoming independent of us. You know, yes, we're providing them a home, but they're supporting their kids to go to school, to have food, all those kinds of things, because the microloan helped them get off the ground. And we provide a little training, and there's a person that monitors all those loans. But that's really been fun. It's really been fun to see that. Yeah. The biggest project that we have is right across the street from our village. The mayor of the town said he'll give us a large tract of land if we develop a market area, because mm-hmm. we're kind of on the outside of town, a little ways out. And so he said, if we can develop a covered market area, he'll give us a large tract of land. I'd also like to put a soccer field on there, just for kids for entertainment. Soccer is gigantic in Haiti, and so we'd like to have a little soccer field there. But we really need to get that going because the mayor, I think he's out of the office later this year, early in the next year. And if he's out, that guarantee goes away. And so sure. If we start that project, we can procure a large tract of land, which is, we can't let that go. Yeah. So then the women right across have a place right across from the village where they can go now to bring their wares to sell. And we think it'll generate a little bit of income just to kind of keep it going. We'll charge them a small amount. We will probably have some storage bins. They'll have some, you know, sort of small charge where they can store their items. They don't have to carry them back home. So we'll generate a little bit of income just to kind of maintain that. It's not going to build the whole thing, but it's going to maintain the property and maintain the things that need to be maintained.
You've written about and talked about hope. What does hope look like in Haiti for you right now?
You know, I think there is some break in what I see happening with the gangs. I am hopeful that there's some stability coming. I haven't been able to be there personally since 2024. I'd like to go back, and we'd like to have teams to go back. So hope for me is like, how do we get teams there safely so they can help the people make connections and then come back and tell people, kind of spread the news, you know, be our cheerleaders and say, you know what, there is actual good ministry going on. We're helping people. I'm always shocked at how hopeful the people are in Haiti. Mm-hmm. And when we go there, we really truly bring hope to them. They're like, someone cares about us. So there are real people that are behind this money that comes to us. And they are very hopeful people, but they have a lot against them right now. And I don't know how that number of people are going to be able to assimilate it back into the culture. The gangs are still strong enough that they are at risk to go back into Haiti, probably more so than just the normal travelers because they're kind of identified as people who are coming back. Sure. And so it's that part is scary, but the people are hopeful, and we, the best thing that we can do is provide hope for them through supporting them through food and the school and clinics and things like that. They know that we care about them because we're continuing to provide services for them.
Yeah. Bruce Bloomer, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for the time.
Bruce Bloomer is co-founder of the South Dakota-based nonprofit Haiti Alive. You can learn more at haitialive.org. And that's our conversation for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.